so you can start your work day the right way with me, your host, Jesse Bell, as we are curating a playlist around a central theme each and every single week. Mondays are rough, but you can make them a lot better by tuning into the Monday Mixtape, Monday mornings, 7 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's news collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Lauren Tucker, Dinah Jansen, and Paige Lang. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. At their last meeting, council voted to provide $300,000 to support the city's first inclusive playground, set to be built in the Rideau Heights district. Over the last year, community members have come together to form the Inclusive Play Project, working with Extenda Family and a number of other organizations, in response to a lack of inclusive and accessible playgrounds in the city. Inclusive Play Project representatives shared evidence of this gap found in a survey the group conducted recently.
We've also recently completed an online survey where we had almost 200 responses. Throughout that survey, we found that 98% of people who responded felt that Kingston playgrounds currently do not meet our community's needs. 98% also said that they did not feel that Kingston playgrounds were inclusive to all. 85% said that they did not feel that our playgrounds currently address the age span of 0 to 12 years, which is what is currently stated.
They also shared some of the most prevalent feedback they received from community members.
On our survey, we also had hundreds of responses that were added to the questions that we asked. I'd just like to take a moment to share a couple with you. One of them stated, "The lack of inclusive play spaces isolated my daughter from her peers and has caused long-term mental health and social difficulties. If she had been able to continue enjoying her friends after she began using a wheelchair, she would likely not have the struggles as significantly as she does." We also heard from a number of families who indicated that the current Kingston parks do not meet the needs of families who have multiple children at different ages and stages and abilities. I think one of the things that we noticed in a lot of the responses with it is that there are a lot of small parquette type places throughout Kingston. And while that makes it so that it's easy to get to one, people are finding that there isn't the play value in terms of wanting to stay for a longer period of time. Or if you have children of multiple different ages, there aren't things there that are interesting for all of them. And so I think that that really kind of struck us in terms of how do you find to develop a space that not only meets the needs for not one age group or ability, but kind of how do you find a way that people can play together and want to stay.
In addition to classic features of a playground like slides and monkey bars, an accessible playground would include features like rubberized surfacing, ramps, and a wheelchair rocker. The project has already received an outpouring of support from the community over the last few months, with close to $200,000 already being raised by Inclusive Play Project volunteers before coming before council last week. Prior to the council meeting, Inclusive Play Project volunteers gathered before City Hall and were even joined by some councillors sporting Inclusive Play Project shirts to show their support.
When we first pitched this idea, it started as a park, and then it became a fundraising campaign. And now what we have on our hands is very clearly a movement that grows by the day, and we are so excited to be a part of it.
Councillors unanimously approved the motion to provide $300,000 from the Municipal Capital Reserve Fund for partial funding of the Inclusive Playground Project. The city also provided public land at Shannon Park and will be conducting maintenance of the structure when it is complete.
Isn't this great to see a community project that started a year ago and look how much progress they have made? I'm humbly urging everyone in this council to endorse this tonight. Think of what addition this would make to Kingston, and that we're really starting a kind of new park that could be a pilot for all other parks in the area.
with the project having an estimated budget of $1.5 million. The Inclusive Play Project is continuing to raise funds. They currently have $650,000 in grant requests pending approval and additional grant applications in progress. There are also high hopes that more of these structures will be built around the city after this milestone is complete.
We don't want this to be the only park. Given the incredible success of the fundraising and just the response from the community, we want to see more of these.
More information about the Inclusive Play Project can be found on their website. The city has provided the first public statement on the status of the Lemoyne Point Farm property, sharing that they are currently in negotiations with the state trustees to acquire the property. The waterfront property located at 2000 Front Road has been a highly discussed topic within the community since longtime owner Mary Fraser passed away in 2022, leaving the space in limbo. Conversations between the city, the estate, and community partners have been behind closed doors until this most recent release. For the city, this property is an opportunity to advance their goals of providing a connected and accessible waterfront and more opportunities for urban farming. At this point, the city and Fraser's estate trustees disagree on how to interpret parts of the will. In the update from the city, it was explained that Fraser's will gives the city an option to purchase the property under certain conditions, including keeping, as far as possible, the property zoned for rural use. They are currently awaiting advice and guidance from the Ontario Superior Court to move forward. In the release, it was stated, quote, "The city recognizes the importance of respecting Ms. Fraser's intentions as well as the property's natural and cultural heritage significance to the residents of Kingston. The city is committed to continuing to work with the estate trustees through negotiation, mediation, or if necessary, litigation to advance the city's interpretation of Ms. Fraser's will," end quote. Advocates for the preservation and community use of the property at 2000 Front Road, the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group, have been supportive of the city's pursuit to acquire the property. CFRC sat down with Jim Biagi, a member of the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group. Here is a bit of that conversation. This is the first public statement the city has made on the Lemoyne Point Farm property in this explicit way. How is SLPF feeling about this development?
We're quite pleased. The city has mostly discussed the farm, as they call it, 2000 Front Road West, at an in-camera or on an in-camera capacity. And so this announcement is firstly, at least some news about the developments. And then secondly, I think we're quite pleased that the city is so serious about both trying to acquire the property and in their statement indicating how they want to preserve the property for Kingstonians.
Yeah, absolutely. And is this sort of similar to what you've already been told in private discussions or heard through the grapevine, or is this sort of really new information?
We've had some verbal communications with councillors and mayor, but they've been very professional in having the in-camera requirements of not sharing information. I think we had a sense that the city was in communication with the estate already and looking at the possibility of buying the property, but two years and some months have passed since the estate became active when the prior owner Mary Fraser died. So it's been quite a while.
BIG also clarified the nature of the disagreements and how to interpret the will referred to in the update.
There are questions for clarity around the requirements of the will and the interests of the city. So two appraisals have been submitted on the property with quite disparate numbers, one at roughly $9 million and one at roughly $29 million. And the average, of course, is an average of two very disparate numbers. And so the terms that apply if the city does acquire the property is to maintain the property as a rural designation, which would put its value much less than if the property was put open to development. And we, I suppose if there is some speculation, I think that's where you might see a big discrepancy between a lower appraisal number and a higher appraisal number. After some negotiation between the estate and the city, the executors of the estate filed a notice of application in the Toronto, Ontario Superior Court, asking for advice clarifying the meaning of some aspects of the secondary will. And so the executors are asking the court to do several things: clarify the authority of the estate trustees to select appraisers, to rule on the right of the city to review the appraiser's methodology, to confirm the meaning of certain clauses about the city purchasing the farm, and to request that a decision be forthcoming within 180 days. So there does seem at least to be an attempt to conclude this business in a relatively timely fashion.
At this point, the city has declined requests for further comment, stating that the information distributed through the short release is all that can be provided at this time. More details will be shared in the future, and the city encourages community organizations and residents to continue to share their input.
Overall, I would say that our group is very pleased with the city's position and their eagerness to look at the property as an area that could be beneficial to the whole city of Kingston, which is exciting.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News with the latest on the Lemoyne Point Farm property.
Thanks so much, Christina. Here's your arts and culture news for today. Continuing this month at the TED until August 31st, we'll be contemplating Glaciers, A Dialogue, a solo exhibition from artist Jan Kabatoff, curated by Jessica Turner. The exhibition will include photography, sculpture, paintings, video, audio, and even a virtual reality element using the Oculus headset, as well as footage from a documentary on the melting of the Athabasca Glacier, which is currently in production from this creative team. All ages are welcome to peruse this exhibition in the TED Center Gallery, and it is free to do so, though exhibition hours may vary. There's also new events and exhibitions at the TED all the time, and you can learn more at tedcenter.org/events. Registration for fall term programming at the Kingston School of Art is now open, including programs for youth and adults, as well as workshops. This includes adult classes in drawing, fiber and textile arts, mixed media, painting, printmaking, and sculpture, and youth programs for kids ages 6 to 16 and families. There's also a variety of 1 and 2 day workshops available for registration. As well, applications are now open for the first annual KSOA member show, and members can submit pieces on their website now. For more information and to register, visit ksoa.info. This and every summer Tuesday, you can head down to Springer Market Square for Salsa in the Square from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., enjoy a free beginner class, and then hit the open dance floor until 10 p.m. Also, every Wednesday summer evening, enjoy Swingin' Summer, a live music throwback to the era of romantic, joyful, and jazzy songs in the Square from 7 to 8 p.m. And every summer Friday evening, Springer Market Square hosts Kickin' It Country from 7 to 8 p.m., featuring live local country music. For more on these events, visit downtownkingston.ca. Every Monday at Daft Brewing, Bon Evans hosts Music Trivia Mondays at 7 p.m. Put your music knowledge to the test in 4 more rounds of trivia, whether you're going it solo or in a team with clips, questions, and more. The winning team walks away at the end of the night with a $50 gift card and bragging rights, so be sure to check it out for a Monday night of music and fun. Kingston welcomes back Movies in the Square and Springer Market Square on Thursday evenings this summer, and the full lineup has now been announced. This week, August 22nd, Night at the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian, starts at dusk. You can also catch Lilo and Stitch on August 29th. Be sure to mark your calendars now and bring your blankets, chairs, and bug spray to experience your favorite films for free this summer under the stars. Coming up at Kingston's Independent Cinema, The Screening Room, you can catch special screenings of 1940's Rebecca on August 20th and 22nd, and 1963's The Birds on August 24th, 26th, 27th, 28th, and 29th as part of the Summer Alfred Hitchcock Presents series. As well, 1974's Phantom of Paradise will be shown in 50th anniversary screenings on August 20th, 21st, and 22nd. as well. 40th anniversary screenings of Purple Rain will be playing on August 24th, 27th, 28th, and 29th. Also coming up at the screening room is Cat Video Fest 2024 from August 17th to 22nd, a fundraiser where 10% of all ticket sales will be donated to Kingston Animal Rescue, featuring compilations of the latest and best cat videos of the internet on the big screen. Their 2024 classic movie poll for audience suggestions is now open at their website, and there are also new arrivals and special screenings all the time, so be sure to check back at screeningroomkingston.com for all of your cinema adventures. That's all I've got for you on Arts Desk today. Now I'll turn it over to Jesse Bell at the Sports Desk.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and today's sports report is actually a special teaser trailer hyping the upcoming season of Queens football right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. This is our 101st season covering the team, and as you'll hear with this teaser trailer, it's shaping up to be one of the most eventful seasons ever.
Absolute heartbreaker at Richardson Stadium. I'm gonna be sick. This is the worst day of my life. Rolling, throwing, picked, ball game. Western will win as Alex Freakin's heroic attempt comes up short.
The greater the expectations, the heavier the weight. And in 2023, the Queen's Gaels had the weight of the world on their shoulders. And then it all came crashing down.
Alex Freakin is down after a gutless hit!
But in spite of the losses, the injuries, and the overwhelming weight of great expectations, this Gaels team did not crumble. And now a new season means new expectations. New pressures, new challenges, and most importantly, a new opportunity for the Gaels to be golden once more. Can this squad end the title drought? Will Queens become kings of Ontario football? There's only one way to find out, and there's only one place to catch all the action.
This is electric. This is Queens football on CFRC.
Now for your CFRC traffic report for this evening. Pavement rehabilitations will be taking place along Highway 401 between Westbrook Road to beyond the Highway 15 overpass and on the Sir John A. McDonald overpass. This work will consist of various lane and ramp closures over the next several months. Highway 401 eastbound and westbound at Sydenham Road to Gardner's Road, lane and ramp closures. August 19th from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m., August 20th from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m., August 21st from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m., and August 22nd from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. PSPC wishes to advise users that the LaSalle Causeway is still fully closed to motorists, cyclists, and pedestrians until further notice. In road closures to look out for this week, Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert, closed until December 31st to accommodate construction activity. Cataract Way Woods Drive at Holden and at Woodhaven, closed beginning August 20th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. each day to accommodate signage installation and line painting. Cooper Street, Albert to Collingwood, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Hillcrest Avenue, Kings Court to 7th, closed until September 1st for buried infrastructure replacement. The road will remain open to local traffic. King Street, Plast Arms to north end of King, closed until September 30th for the construction of new storm and roadbed. Road will be open to local traffic. Market Street, King to Ontario, closed August 23rd from 7 a.m. to 12 a.m. for the Kingston Humane Society event at Springer Market Square. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen, closed until September 27th for downtown Kingston BIA activations. Union Street, Victoria to Albert, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation. For project details, you can visit Get Involved Kingston. University Avenue, Union to Earl, closed for the Queens JDUC project. Wellington Street, Earl to Gore, closed beginning August 19th to September 10th for a new water service installation. And finally, Wellington Street, Main to George, closed until August 30th to accommodate construction-related activity for the Berryfield Highlands subdivision project. In parking disruptions, the Hanson Memorial Parking Restoration Project is underway and is expected to conclude in late December 2024. No more than 50% of the available 271 parking spaces will be closed at any time. There is also parking availability at the Chun Memorial and Robert Bruce Memorial parking garages and the two adjacent blocks to the west. In other delays, Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl, expect delays and closures along Aberdeen while construction work is done. Bay Ridge Drive, Princess to Taylor Kidd, expect delays while a contractor begins phase two of the Bay Ridge Drive active transportation upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles Edwin to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes phase two of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. John Counter Boulevard at Montreal, expect delays while a contractor completes interim intersection improvements. Work will take place overnight from Sunday night to Friday mornings during the week and on weekends during the day. Johnson Street, Portsmouth to Robert Wallace. Expect a westbound lane closure until August 29th for storm sewer and gas relocation work. Detours will be in place for the duration of the closure. Portsmouth Avenue, Miles to Johnson, expect a southbound lane closure until August 29th for storm and sewer gas relocation work. Detours will be in place for the duration of the closure. You can find details on any of those projects on Get Involved Kingston. That wraps up your CFRC traffic report for this evening, and next up is your concerts and events calendar with Paige.
It's time for CFRC's concert and events calendar. Have an event you'd like covered? Reach out through CFRC.ca today. On Monday, August 19th, head down to the club at the RCHA for an afternoon of early jazz from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. with Jasmine Wibodish. Tickets are just $5. The Cove Inn host Gerald McGrath is part of their monthly musical residency. Enjoy a solo show with engaging soundscapes from 5 to 8 p.m. and admission is by donation. Head down to the Royal Tavern 2.0 for a night of poetry, storytelling, and music. This event is free to attend and runs from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. On Tuesday, August 20th, enjoy a happy hour and jam with Tom Savage and friends at the club at the RCHA. The afternoon show runs from 4 to 7 p.m. and is free to attend. Montreal-based British-French producer Joni Boyd is coming to Hotel Wolf Island this Tuesday. They play experimental camatronic multi-genre music and the show runs from 6 to 9 p.m. and is free to attend. From 6:30 to 10, come dance in Springer Market Square with Salsa in the Square. Featuring electrifying beats, spicy moves, and fun, no experience necessary. The event is free to attend. From 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m., enjoy Ontario's oldest market in Kingston Market Square, featuring local produce, pre-made food, and artisanal crafts. Open every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. On Wednesday, August 21st, Hotel Wolf Island is hosting Winnipeg-based trio The Jansen Boys. From 6 to 9 p.m., enjoy rootsy, harmony-based folk. The show is free to attend. Walk down the Springer Market Square for Swing in Summer for the romantic songs of yesteryear with LaSalle Causeway Swing Band. The show plays from 7 to 8 p.m. and is free to attend. Bring your friends and family and enjoy the summer weather. Bring your competitive spirit to DAF Brewing for trivia. The game is from 7 to 9:30 p.m. Teams can be a max of 6 people and there is $100 in prizes. The event is free to attend. Grab a drink and have fun. Experience a night of military precision, disciplined marching, rifle drills, and fireworks at historic Fort Henry with the Fort Henry Guard. The show is from 7 to 8:30 p.m., perfect time to watch the sunset with friends and family. For tickets, go to www.forthenry.com. On Thursday, August 22nd, Juno Award-winning blues artist Garrett Mason is playing the Cove Inn. Tickets are $25 and the show runs from 8 to 10 p.m. Have a trippy Thursday night with genre-fluid psychedelic band Holy Wow playing Hotel Wolf Island. The show runs from 8:30 to 11 p.m. and admission is by donation. Kingston Blues Society presents three nights of blues and fun at outdoor venues as well as the club at the RCHA. Featuring George Kilby Jr., Miss Emily, Hellbound Trail, and Sweet Pete in the Heat. For ticket information and venues, check out eventbrite.ca. Have an old hoodie collecting dust bunnies in the back of your closet? Bring it over to DAF Brewing and support Hoodies for the Homeless, a live music event featuring local Kingston artists Clem Chesterfield, The Millwrights, Laser Bear, Tom Savage, and more. The event starts at 5 p.m. and the music starts at 6 p.m. Need an idea for a date night or are the kids getting antsy? Head over to Springer Market Square for the Movies in the Park. This Thursday features Night at the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian. The movie starts when the sun goes down around 8 p.m. Don't forget your lawn chair and extra cash for snacks. On Friday, August 23rd, every Friday from 7 to 10 p.m., Christopher Jackson and friends play Blue Martini for a rockin' good time. Admission is free. Put on your dancing shoes and head over to Hotel Wolf Island for Bill Coleman. Enjoy a night of improvised dance music from 7 to 9 p.m. Admission is free. Dust off your cowboy boots for a night of country at Next Church, featuring Hobby, Cody Allen James and Good Co., Customer Service, and Brock Mattson. The show is from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. and tickets are $15. Head down to Springer Market Square for Tunes for Tales, celebrating 140 years of compassion with the Kingston Humane Society. Featuring Miss Emily, The Wilderness, and Evan Rotella, the show starts at 7 p.m. and is free to attend. The Toucan hosts Kingston-based artists Futura Free, Willy Nilly, The Echoes, and Matt Almeida from 10:30 to 2 a.m. Hang out and have a drink and enjoy the night of live music for free. Kingston Penn Tours welcome back outdoor movies at Kingston Penn. This Friday is a screening of Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, and Saturday is Oppenheimer. Doors open at 7 p.m. and the movie starts at 8 p.m. Don't forget your lawn chair. Tickets are general admission at $18.70 plus tax, and don't forget to bring extra cash for snacks. On Saturday, August 24th, are you a fan of John Mellencamp, James Taylor, and Blue Rodeo? Well, Jeff Callery's for you. Head down to the Cove Inn from 5 to 8 p.m. to enjoy the tunes for free. Spend your Saturday night at the Royal Tavern 2.0 featuring Courtney Kane from 3 to 5 p.m., Paula Wood from 6 to 8 p.m., and stay late with Crystal Fisher in the Engine 1095 from 9 to 2 a.m. Admission is free. Local bands Rated Blue and the Evan Jackson Band are playing the Toucan from 10:30 p.m. to 2 a.m. Grab a drink and hang out and enjoy. The admission is free. Limestone City Burlesque takes on Shakespeare like you've never seen before. Leather, chains, regicide. Need I say more? Head down to the Royal Theatre Thousand Islands to watch the show from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. Tickets are $20. Bring your friends and family to Sydenham Street from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. this Saturday for summer fun on Sydenham, featuring live music from Roger James, family-friendly activities, and fun entertainers. Head down to Top Shelf Distillers August 24th and 25th for the Ontario Moonshine Festival, featuring live music, food, and unique spirits. This is something for everyone. The event runs from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and is free for all ages. On Sunday, August 25th, support the celebration of Little Cat's 60th anniversary with Cataraqui Conservation. Featuring local musicians Sticky Henderson and Christopher Jackson, the show is held in the beautiful Little Cataraqui Creek Conservation Area from 1 to 4 p.m. and tickets are $20. The show is for all ages. The Pub at the Opinicon presents Somerset Combo as part of their 2024 live music series. From 2 to 5 p.m., enjoy the outdoor show. Reservations are encouraged. The show is free. Singer-songwriter with inspirations of folk, country, and rock, Tyson Sullivan is playing Spearhead Brewery this Sunday. From 2 to 5 p.m., enjoy the music. Admission is free. Enjoy the music of ABBA at Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts from 8:45 to 10:15 p.m. The candlelit tribute brings true magic to your Sunday. The tickets are $35, general admission. Head over to Kingston Memorial Center for Loving Spoonful and the Memorial Farmers Market's new event, a block party featuring artists DJ Third Place and GJLK. The party is a celebration of local food and runs from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Bring your friends and enjoy the traditional market with a festive flair. The event is free to attend. Montreal Street Collective presents a vintage market on Montreal Street, featuring several downtown vintage thrift shops and local artisans. The market runs from 9 to 5 p.m. The event is free to attend. That's all for this week's concert and events calendar.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
On Saturday, August 24th, it all begins again.
the ecstasy.
Richard Stadium comes alive. Alex Freakin is hype. I'm hype. I love football.
The exhilaration.
And there he goes. That man is bad. That man is fast. And he is up over the 50, still on his feet.
The heartbreak.
And Laurier wins on an absolute heartbreaker at Richardson Stadium.
The pain.
No!
All part of a long journey to football immortality for the Queen's Gaels. And on Saturday, August 24th, in Windsor, Ontario, it all begins again. 3:45 p.m. pregame show, 4 p.m. kickoff, and there's only one place you can catch all the action.
This is Queen's Football on CFRC.
Turn up the fun with Kingston Frontenac Public Library's summer reading programs, free and open to all ages, with the chance to win great prizes like Stanley tumblers, Lululemon bags, gift cards, and a Nintendo Switch. Make this summer one for the books. Register now at kfpl.beanstack.com.
This is CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus and community radio station, broadcast from the basement of Kerutas Hall, Queen's University, Kingston. You can also hear this program locally on Cogeco Cable, channel 282, and is streamed online at cfrc.ca. Welcome to Biotech Beat. This is your host, Chris Roth. Today we will hear a keynote address by Professor Joseph Allen on the topic Tackling Air Pollution. This program was produced and distributed by the Institute of International and European Affairs, Ireland. Before that, a few messages.
Tree Canada's National Greening Program is planting seedlings across five regions of the country: BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They plant in areas that are in need of reforestation or afforestation across Canada. Tree Canada selects sites where appropriate native species will be planted to make sure that natural forests come back to life. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband, Tom, and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it. So can you. For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
CFRC is active on every social media platform. Check us out at CFRC Radio on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and on Twitter at CFRC.
Today, we are delighted to be joined by Professor Joseph Allen, all the way from Boston. I'd like to thank him for being so generous with his time to speak to us this afternoon. Joseph G. Allen is director of the Healthy Buildings Program and an associate professor at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Before joining the faculty at Harvard, he spent several years in the private sector, leading teams of scientists and engineers to investigate and resolve hundreds of indoor environmental quality issues, including sick buildings, so-called sick buildings, cancer clusters, and biological chemical hazards. His academic research focuses on the critical role the indoor built environment plays in our overall health. One of the world's leading experts on healthy buildings, Dr. Allen is a regular keynote speaker and advises leading global companies. He's the co-author of Healthy Building. The title of Professor Allen's presentation this afternoon, Tackling Air Pollution. He's going to speak to us for about 20 minutes. I can see on my screen that thankfully we are joined by our good friend and colleague, Dr. Micheál Lehane, Director of the EPA's Office of Radiation Protection and Environmental Monitoring. And I'm going to invite Micheál now, if I may, to offer some opening remarks this afternoon. Micheál, you're more than welcome.
Thank you, Alex. That's great. And just I'd like to also echo that welcome to this second event in the Environmental Resilience Lecture Series. This is co-organized by ourselves and the IIEA. So we know the link, you know, that the link between solid fuel combustion for home heating in our towns and villages has and the negative effects of the fine particulate matter PM2.5 in ambient air is well understood. And it's been highlighted by ourselves in many successful reports over the years. The current understanding of those impacts at low levels as well of this pollutant PM2.5 has also informed the World Health Organization to reduce and significantly reduce its annual ambient air quality guidance level. And I think in addition to this, this is where today really is important, I think, for us and for everybody's interest in air quality. There's a growing volume of research in the impact of solid fuel heating systems on our indoor air quality. So I'm really looking forward to listening more about the impacts of air pollution on our indoor spaces and on the strategies to combat air pollution indoor environments to make our homes, our schools and our offices healthy places to live, study and work in. So now I invite Professor Allen to deliver his address.
Well, thank you. That was a really nice introduction. And I'm looking forward to the conversation. It's quite an honor to be invited to hopefully set the stage for a rich conversation and question and answer session on the topic of environmental resilience and specifically the role of buildings, right? As we think about outdoor air pollution, of course, the dirty secret of outdoor air pollution is it penetrates indoors. And because we spend the vast majority of our life indoors, even as that outdoor air pollution concentration is reduced as it comes inside, the majority of your exposure to outdoor air pollution occurs indoors. That does surprise a lot of people to hear that. The majority of your exposure to outdoor air pollution can occur indoors. My goals for this session is to kind of set the stage for a rich discussion, but also place buildings at the center of a lot of these problems we're talking about. Buildings consume 40% of global energy. In some cities, it's 70 or higher, 70% of global energy. They're at the center of our climate crisis. We spend majority of our time indoors, and we see an indoor how the indoor environment influences our health. And because buildings, as I hope to show, are at the center of the problems, that means they're at the center of the solution set, or they have to be as we think about long-term climate mitigation, adaptation, and also healthier indoor environments. So I like to start my presentations with a little thought experiment, asking people what you know about healthy living. So if you were to ask a general audience, what do you know about healthy living? And also, how do you know what constitutes a healthy lifestyle? If you ask that question, you're going to get good answers around things like this. I know I should exercise every day. That's good for my health. I know I should eat healthy, and we know what healthy foods are. We know what unhealthy foods are. We know that outdoor air pollution is bad for us. We know we shouldn't smoke cigarettes. And so how do we know all of this? And I'd argue that we have much of the knowledge, or what the public understands constitutes healthy living, comes from these great human epidemiological cohort studies. They follow tens of thousands of people for years, decades, and look at their lifestyle, environmental factors, genetic factors, and health outcomes. And if you look at all of these great studies, though, you see a glaring hole. None of them talk about the role of the building. And because we don't look at the building in these great big studies, these long-term cohort studies, we have a knowledge gap. And the public, therefore, has the knowledge gap. So in its place, what we have is a relatively small field of indoor air quality scientists, relatively underfunded, grossly underfunded compared to other aspects of environmental health or public health. Yet it has an outsized impact on our health. And we don't actually have to go much farther than look right at what happened with COVID and why this was such a problem. Besides being novel to our immune systems, we had a failure to recognize that the building plays a critical role in keeping us safe from this respiratory virus and others. I've been writing about this from the beginning of the pandemic. Here's an article in the New York Times, March 2020, placing buildings at the center of our response to the COVID-19 crisis. Yet, if you recall that time period, much of the guidance, and it still persists today, was around fomite transmission or shared surfaces or droplet transmission. And this idea that if you stay just 2 meters or 6 feet from somebody, you're going to be okay. And we were cleaning our deep cleaning buildings and people didn't want to handle the mail or be careful with groceries. We fundamentally missed that this virus is an airborne virus. Nearly all spread happening indoors. So spread through the air, all spread indoors, nearly all. So what does that mean? Well, buildings had to be the centerpiece of our response. And for much of the world missed this for a year or more. So I don't want to dwell on COVID, but I want to talk about four fundamental shifts that are coming out of COVID as it relates to our buildings. The first is this. As we are here, not together, but you're all in your room watching this, wherever you are, when you're with other people, you're out at school, the office, the grocery store, we are constantly emitting respiratory aerosols. These aerosols are all different sizes. The majority, if someone's infectious, the majority of that virus travels in the smaller aerosols that travel well beyond two meters. And this is a work we did with the New York Times, visualizing respiratory aerosols in a classroom. Same thing would hold in any office, conference room, bus, airplane. Very quickly, you see that the aerosols of everyone in the room are mixing and they're traveling beyond this. They fill up the room. So we have all spread happening indoors. We have aerosols that travel beyond 2 meters and a buildup of aerosols in underventilated or underfiltered spaces. So the first key takeaway is that the scientific and medical literature is being rewritten. Really, it was decades of over-focused on droplet transmission, these large droplets that fall out of the air within 2 meters. That's being rewritten in the top medical journals, New England Journal of Medicine, The Lancet, JAMA. Global scientists agreeing on this. And it's this principle that as you have an infectious person, relatively quickly, these aerosols travel very quickly beyond 2 meters or 6 feet, fill up an entire room. And the concentration of infectious particles or viral particles in the air is dependent upon the size of the room, number of people infected, and ventilation and filtration. And with relatively simple strategies, increasing ventilation, enhancing filtration, you can decrease the concentration. So that's first fundamental takeaway, is this airborne transmission being recognized as the dominant mode of transmission. We should have gotten this right in year one, took several years to get there. Second key takeaway that says the focus on buildings now is not going away. We have a very savvy public now. Everyone is very knowledgeable on infectious disease transmission. I always say my neighbor now talks to me about filtration and ventilation. Here's something I pulled from a website called Glassdoor, which is where people talk about their jobs. Usually, they talk about salary and culture and what job title they have and what the work is like. Well, they're also talking about their building. In my book, I talk about it as your employees are interviewing your building. So I pulled one that I thought was really quite interesting. This company now has this statement linked to their company forever, where someone says, how is being in this office any different than being on a virus-infected cruise ship for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week? So employees are recognizing that the building is playing a role in their health. You now have a widespread awareness of this. You have an entire media and social media ecosystem focused on this. That's not going away anytime soon. And in fact, you have people now monitoring indoor air quality and reporting on it. I showed this on CNN, this monitor. I have several monitors behind me right now. They're relatively low cost. And people are sharing this. The same device now that used to be available only to scientists, people can go in and they measure in the school, the classroom, in a coffee shop, and they report on this in social media. So hyper-aware public that is now has the tools to measure and verify indoor air quality. Okay. Third, it has finally been recognized that buildings are central to this fight. I'm proud to have been an advisor to the White House for the past year in the U.S. As of February 2020, President Biden elevated buildings, this clean air in buildings challenge, elevated it on par with vaccines, therapeutics, testing in the pandemic response. That is a major shift, and it will lead to a continued long-term shift. And here's what's coming next. The problem has been that you have buildings built designed for low ventilation rates. This is a figure showing a 100-year history of ventilation rates. I'm not going to go through all the detail, but I want to point this out. The dotted red line is the level at which we knew 100 years ago was sufficient or helpful in reducing or mitigating infectious disease transmission indoors. In the past 100 years, globally, we have decreased the ventilation rate. So is it any surprise? We have a novel virus that's spread through the air, nearly entirely indoors, meets a building stock that is underventilated. We've choked off the air supply in our buildings. These respiratory aerosols build up. And if you look at every single super spreader event, you'll find that same thing. Time indoors, underventilated, underfiltered. This is by design. We designed our buildings incorrectly for the past, really, the past 40 years in particular. We've decreased our ventilation rate. What to do about this? I want to highlight a report from the Lancet COVID-19 Commission. I chair the Lancet's Task Force on Safe Work, Safe School, and Safe Travel. We put out a report just a couple of weeks ago trying to simplify this. The first four strategies every building should pursue. One, give your building a tune-up, just like you do for your car. We do this every year for our car. Buildings, similarly, start to perform worse over time. We need to give them a tune-up to bring them back to where they should be performing. Maximize ventilation rates. Upgrade your filtration. Deploy portable air cleaners where necessary. That's the third big change coming. The fourth is this. This issue of COVID and ventilation, air quality, has now opened a much more broad conversation about all the factors in the indoor environment that influence health. So here's a report my Harvard team put out called The 9 Foundations of a Healthy Building, talking about water quality, lighting, biophilic design, the influence of dust and mold, and acoustical quality and thermal conditions. And what I've seen is that the entry point to be thinking differently about our buildings was COVID, ventilation, air quality. And now major multinational organizations, companies, the White House in the US, are rethinking our entire strategy around buildings and how we can improve the condition for everybody indoors with a wider lens on what constitutes healthy buildings. I tell you, I have more content, but I'm right at 8:20. And I want to be sure we have a lot of time for question and answer and discussion. But some of the other things maybe I'll just tee up before I finish here is that there is a great convergence happening. So you had a green buildings movement focused on energy efficiency and climate. You have a smart buildings movement talking about sensors and smart buildings and maybe indoor air quality. You have these safety professionals and the safety and security community over here. Well, there's this great convergence happening now that has to happen, and it's converging around healthy buildings. Because we have to design buildings that are both optimized for human health and safety and comfort without ignoring the building's contribution to climate change. And there's been this false dichotomy presented for decades that we have to have either a healthy building, higher ventilation rates, use more energy, or energy efficiency, we choke off the air supply and have an unhealthy building. That's false. And there are many examples of how we can actually optimize both, optimize indoor health while making sure we're protecting health beyond the four walls of the building through better energy decisions. So a lot to talk about on the climate side, sustainability side, healthy materials, the business case for healthy buildings. But I want to see what you all want to talk about. And I'll say this last thing before we get to question and answer. I want to wrap it up on a high note here. Like I said, that buildings are the center of all these problems. That means they're they're center to the solution set. This is not just we don't know what to do. We actually have the tools available to us. And nothing less than this is at stake. The decisions we make today regarding our buildings determines our collective health now and for generations. That is said without exaggeration. So I want to thank you for letting me open up just a few comments, hopefully to seed a nice conversation here. And I'm looking forward to what questions and comments you all have. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And in fact, you did a lot better than 20 because, of course, you. One thing that occurred to me, I just ask you, and you did an interesting contextual reference at the outset. So during COVID, so much of what the public health advice and the, you know, government advice had to do with proximity of individuals and all of the stuff that we were told, and, you know, 2 meters and so forth. And whereas so many other things were not, in fact, referenced, or at least not referenced sufficiently early on or in a sufficiently robust manner, that seemed to come into the debate. Although there were some voices, perhaps some lone voices, even here in Ireland, in fairness, who were saying that this was the agenda we should be looking at. How much of that, I wonder, had to do with the kind of imperative of, you know, getting the advice out so that stuff that could be done quickly, you know, stuff that people felt they could do quickly, maybe was in the area of proximity and, you know, hand washing and all the hygiene. And that there may have been a perception, and really, I suppose this is my question, I wonder how fair is that perception, that really the things we need to do with buildings are going to take longer. You know, they're much more, obviously at the design and build stage, well then that's to do with the design and build of a building. And even some of the adjustments that might usefully be made to buildings, they take time. So I'm just wondering, could you reflect for a few minutes on that whole business of, like, the kind of the timelines for the sort of change that you say are most important, perhaps mitigating against the public health advice, is the fear that these things just take too long to rectify?
Yeah, I think you raise a couple of really good points there. And we could talk about really what implementation looks like. I think that's fair. I'd tell you the first piece I wrote before that New York Times piece in March 2020 was early February 2020 in Financial Times. And it placed buildings at the forefront of the response, but acknowledged that there was a lot of uncertainty. And until that uncertainty was resolved, we should do a lot of everything, which meant, yeah, hand washing makes a lot of sense. Distancing makes sense. There's, and your cone of emissions is greater at close distance. So that makes sense. My real issue was that in the totality of response in the early days and early months, in fact, the first year, the buildings were ignored. So it was very much we should do all this stuff. We tried everything, flatten the curve. We did everything, but we didn't do a little of everything when it came to ventilation and filtration. And my goal, like many scientists around the world, wasn't just me. There are plenty of voices out there trying to raise the alarm. I co-authored a piece to the WHO in Science with an international group of colleagues all over the world. Great scientists in indoor air quality raising the alarm on this, saying, well, this has to be part of the discussion. So it doesn't mean we don't do these other things. Masking was important. All this was very important until we resolved it, right? It's a precautionary principle. But we had evidence before SARS-CoV-2. For example, SARS-1, we had evidence was spread via the airborne route. So there was a lot of pushback that said, we don't really know. In fact, if you look at my field's scientific literature, we know that ventilation and filtration are key to reducing risk from influenza indoors and measles and TB and SARS-1. So we had we had everything we needed to know. And if you look at that first report, it's very similar to this last report I mentioned, the first four. So what were the first things we were calling for? Better ventilation, better filtration, and portable air cleaners. So let me address the implementation question. Is this fair? Well, this is too expensive to overhaul my mechanical HVAC system, or it takes 2 years to do this, or it's too expensive. I don't think that's the case. One, on the expense side, there was in the US billions of dollars of stimulus globally, right? And the money was there in terms of the response. It's also not expensive to do these fixes. And we also laid out a plan for what you can do in the short term while you address, let's say, the building level systems that might take longer. So, for example, written 50 articles in New York Times, Washington Post, in the US, saying we could deploy portable air cleaners. And I talked to all the manufacturers. They had the stock available. Portable air cleaner with a HEPA filter, you could put in this room or any room. And if you size it right, you can get 4, 5, 6 air changes per hour of clean air. Typical home in the US has half an air change per hour. Typical school has 1.5 air changes. That's not a lot of turnover of air. With a simple plug and play device that costs a couple hundred dollars, let's take schools for classrooms, US dollars. That's a couple dollars per student per year. You could clean the air while you're thinking about how to spend stimulus dollars on an overhaul of your mechanical system if that's what's needed. So we had the short-term solutions while we could build to the longer-term upgrades if needed. If you look at this first four report from The Lancet, I think it's really important because we got our, it's an expert group of international scientists. And we got together and said, what are the four things if every building did? It's very doable, not expensive, and would really move the needle or, you know, improve the condition of people in buildings, residential, offices, factories. And the first one is really important, that tune-up idea. Because that's something every building can do right now. And buildings have are built to a design standard, not a performance standard. So they slip over time. And if we just brought buildings back up to the way they were performed, that improves, empirically, studies have been shown, improves overall indoor air quality and saves energy, good for climate, and saves money. So it's actually a cost-saving approach that improves indoor air quality. It's an absolute first thing that has to be done. And then you could think about, how do I go above and beyond with filtration, ventilation, and use these portables as a stopgap measure? So it's, I don't think it's the case. I think it's a fair question. A lot of people have that question. I don't think healthy buildings are expensive. I don't think they're hard to do. And we have short-term things we can do to respond while we work on longer-term improvements.
That's terrific. So plenty of questions coming in now and plenty of interest. I'm going to pitch two questions at you. First of all, Theodorus van Veldhoven asks a simple and straightforward question. What's a cost-effective and easy measure that many people could take to improve the air quality of their own dwelling? I suppose allied to that is the fact that so many of us are working from home so much, as indeed I am today, for example, and many people do. So simple and easy measure, cost-effective and easy measure. And then I'm just going to put the other one to you as well at the same time, if you don't mind sort of memorizing both. Short question as well. Anthony Joseph Brogan says that research has shown that plant-based ionizers are effective in significantly reducing aerosols indoors. Is this hybrid approach the way forward? He's wondering.
So a couple of thoughts there. I like the question about the home, and I'll take it beyond COVID. How do we improve indoor air quality? First, let's take the source control. I think we have to do a better job at thinking about the products we put in our homes, low VOC, low volatile organic chemicals, thinking about other semi-volatile chemicals like these forever chemicals, if you're not familiar with them, the stain repellent chemicals that actually are associated with a whole health, whole host of adverse health effects. So do a better job in terms of our the source control, switching out natural gas stoves for electric stoves, natural gas stoves emit a whole host of indoor pollutants that are bad for respiratory health, exacerbate asthma. So that's number one. Two, I think some simple things, if you don't have mechanical air, should be opening up the windows as much as we can, increase ventilation rate. So I'm a bad example here. So my CO2 levels, I have my meter somewhere, you know, generally very high in my office, unless I crack open the window a little bit. We've really tightened up our buildings. So when you can, when the weather's nice, open up the window. Some really simple things. I'll give people a tip on that one. My Harvard team wrote a report called Homes for Health. And if you just search on this, look up Harvard Healthy Buildings, Homes for Health. We have 36 expert tips for a healthier home. Kick off your shoes before you walk in the door. Ventilating. Make sure you're above your stove. You have exhaust ventilation, right? So you're capturing these pollutants and particles when you cook. Simple things, really written for the public. Simple things you can do. So there's a lot we can actually do to improve our health, especially in our homes.
Great.
Second question on ionization. I think there's a lot of new technologies out there in terms of ionization. I'm usually cautious when it, so I'm not anti-new technology. I'm just cautious. I think we have to evaluate any new technology across these three questions. Does it work? Simple enough. Does it produce any potentially harmful byproducts? And three, what problem is it solving? Is it replacing one of those first four measures because they're not sufficient? So the first one, I think, on the ionizer question, depends on the technology, depends on the exact tool, but I think there's lots of debate about how effective they are. Two, is it safe? I think for me, the idea of releasing anything into the air constantly, whether it be a chemical or ions, we have to be careful that we are fundamentally changing the air. You can create secondary pollutants like ultrafine particles, or you can convert complex VOCs into other VOCs that may be respiratory hazards. So is it changing the air and is it safe? I think it depends on the technology, how it's deployed and things like this. And third, what's it replacing? So can't we just solve this with better ventilation, better filtration, which we know come with a lot of other benefits? I can talk a lot about plants and biophilic design if that comes up in another question, but I would think about those questions when you think about new technology, those three questions. Does it work? Is it safe? And also fundamentally, what is it solving that can't be solved through these other methods that have decades of science behind them supporting their benefits?
Great. Patrick Kenny asks whether you'd comment on current US research on impacts of mold and spores on indoor health and how building design can either mitigate or worsen their impacts.
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of research there, and this is right, decades old, old field, but it's one of the nine foundations of a healthy building.
That's it, folks.